Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and this is For the Record program number 346, Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Part 3, Nation Building by the Underground Reich. This is being recorded on February 3rd of the year 2002, and this is going to continue with discussion and, more specifically, analysis of the events in and around and attendant upon the terrorist blitzkrieg of September 11th, 2001. In the two preceding broadcasts in this sequence, I advanced my working hypothesis that not only are the political, economic, domestic, and foreign policy aspects of the September 11th, 2001 attacks inextricably linked, they in turn are linked to the political theories of, among others, Karl von Clausewitz, the Prussian military theoretician, or that convergence is linked to that, but I have continued with my analysis of the attacks as basically a fusion of the attack on Pearl Harbor, in effect, literally a sneak attack upon the sovereign nation of the United States of America by a hostile foreign fascist power, what I call the Underground Reich. And I am also analyzing this as a Reichstag fire, as what at another level of analysis could be considered an act intended to provoke a predetermined response in the United States, which would hand political, economic, fascist control to an American political leadership clique, which I believe to be a direct extension of the Underground Reich. Quite literally, a Third Reich gone underground and perpetuated in mafia-like fashion, utilizing not only the consummate economic power of the Martin Bormann outfit that I've spoken about so many times in the past, but also the political and national security connections of, among other institutions, the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that we incorporated at the end of World War II, and the institution that to a large extent managed that, and that was Heinrich Mueller's Worldwide Intelligence Outfit. Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo, who ran the security outfit for Martin Bormann. There are many For the Record programs dealing with this subject material, plus archive shows available from Spitfire. In particular, I refer listeners who are going to pursue this information to RFA Show 37, How the United States Lost the Second World War. More information about where you can learn more about this on websites later in the program. Now, we're going to review some information by way of setting the groundwork for discussion of nation building in the United States by the Underground Reich, bearing in mind both the economic power of what I call the transatlantic industrial and financial fascist axis. This is the industrial and financial milieu that not only helped to finance Hitler, but which in turn became inextricably linked with the remarkable and deadly Bormann organization, literally a Third Reich gone underground at the end of World War II. In 1994, St. Martin's Press published a remarkable book with an unfortunate title. That book is called The Secret War Against the Jews, co-authored by former professional military officer and Justice Department investigator John Loftus and his co-author Mark Ahrens. Loftus ran the Justice Department unit that was investigating the importation of Nazi war criminals at the end of World War II. He had a very high security clearance, and in addition to a tremendous amount of academic research, Loftus had power of attorney for a group of former American, British, and Soviet intelligence agents who got permission from a good guy faction inside of the CIA to publish their remarkable story of what had happened in the 20th century on condition of anonymity. The Secret War Against the Jews, subtitled How Western Espionage Betrayed the Jewish People, is the result of the remarkable efforts of Loftus and Ahrens. Now, of the connections between the Bush family, specifically George W.'s great-grandfather, George Herbert Walker, one of Hitler's three earliest financial backers and the man whose last name W. carries as a middle name, and also his grandfather, Prescott Bush Sr., George Walker's son-in-law, George Herbert Walker's son-in-law, who was a partner with George Herbert Walker and his Nazi front companies, specifically the Union Banking Corporation, whose post-war liquidation provided the foundation for the Bush family fortune, and also the Hamburg America line, which became a key element of the Bormann organization in the post-war period. Now, we're going to take a look at the masking of these Nazi assets, that done by Alan Dulles, the Sullivan and Cromwell operative who was a key U.S. intelligence agent from the 1920s right on up through his tenure at the CIA. He also helped to oversee the American investments in pre-Nazi and Nazi Germany. Of the masking of the Bush family Nazi assets by Alan Dulles, Loftus and Ahrens write, speaking here of Prescott Bush Sr., W.'s grandfather, instead of divesting the Nazi money, Bush hired a lawyer to hide the assets. The lawyer he hired had considerable expertise in such underhanded schemes. It was Alan Dulles. Once the government had its hands on Bush's books, the whole story of the intricate web of Nazi front corporations began to unravel. A few days later, two of Union Banking's subsidiaries, the Holland American Trading Corporation and the Seamless Steel Equipment Corporation, also were seized. Then the government went after the Harriman 15 Holding Company, which Bush shared with his father-in-law, Bert Walker, the Hamburg America Line, and the Silesian American Corporation. The U.S. government found that huge sections of Prescott Bush's empire had been operated on behalf of Nazi Germany and had greatly assisted the German war effort. Of course, this Bush entrepreneurship ultimately led to the post-war liquidation of the Union Banking Corporation, which provided the foundation for the Bush family's post-war business ventures. And the Bush family ventures were in partnership with the Thiessen family. That was one of the primary elements of the financial underpinnings of Hitler, and also one of the key elements in the Bormann organization, the post-war underground Reich that we've spoken about in the past. Reviewing another element that we've looked at from the secret war against the Jews, this places Alan Dulles with British fascist and intelligence agent turncoat Jack Philby at the genesis of Saudi Arabia. These two men helped to elevate King Ibn Saud into the throne of what became Saudi Arabia and to corral the petroleum assets for the Third Reich, American oil, and the Underground Reich. Bear in mind that Ibn Saud was a close friend of Mohammed bin Laden, who basically acquired a construction monopoly in Saudi Arabia. So the genesis of the bin Laden family economic empire, is at this very same nexus. Turning to the discussion of Philby and Dulles' elevation of Ibn Saud, we read once again from the Secret War Against the Jews, speaking of Jack Philby, the renegade British intelligence agent plucked an obscure terrorist out of the desert and helped to make him the king of Saudi Arabia. Ibn Saud was very much his creation. Philby stole the information from British intelligence files that engineered Saudi control over the holiest shrines of the Muslim world. Jack Philby and Ibn Saud betrayed the British Empire and made the American oil companies economic masters of the region. The man who helped them do it was Alan Dulles, an American spy who had befriended Philby while he was coordinating American intelligence gathering in the Middle East in the first half of the 1920s. Between them, these three men built the very foundations of the modern Middle East. They were the architects of the oil weapon, the instigators of war, the manipulators of history. More important, Philby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Dulles' profits came from the same source. Note that last sentence. More important, Philby's and Ibn Saud's political and philosophical allegiance was to Nazi Germany, while much of Dulles' profits came from the same source. What we're going to look at now is a post-World War II instance of nation-building in the United States by some of these same elements, utilizing a key intelligence component of what I call the Underground Reich, namely some of the Nazi and Eastern European fascist collaborators of the Third Reich that were inextricably linked with the Reinhard Gehlen Nazi Eastern Front spy outfit that was glommed onto the CIA. And in turn, we're going to take a look at an altogether illegal domestic intelligence operation, which took place in the United States. This was a joint CIA State Department operation called the Crusade for Freedom, in which many of these Nazi and Eastern European fascist collaborators, war criminals of the highest order in many cases, were brought into the United States to become leaders in the large Eastern European ethnic communities in the United States. This was seen as being essential to political nation building in the United States because it was the Republicans' view that the 1948 victory by Truman over Dewey was because of the, quote, Jewish vote, unquote, and they wished to turn the Eastern European ethnic communities in urban America rightward in order to basically bolster the fortunes of the Republican Party. Now, the person who oversaw this operation was Alan Dulles. The person who in turn helped to supervise the Crusade for Freedom, again a domestic nation-building operation by elements of U.S. intelligence with some of these transatlantic financial and industrial connections, and this in turn was accomplished in combination with the Underground Reich. The person who oversaw the Crusade for Freedom was Richard Nixon at the behest of Alan Dulles. Turning to secret war against the Jews. With the help of the Dulles-Angleton clique, the Vatican had sent many of the Eastern European Nazis to Western countries, including the United States, Australia, and Canada, where the right wing recruited them to get out the rest of the Eastern European ethnic vote. The man who ran the political recruitment campaign in the United States was Richard Nixon. We're going to take a look at some of the people who worked on the Dulles-Nixon project. Turning again to the secret war against the Jews, and again this operation was called the Crusade for Freedom. As a young movie actor in the early 1950s, Ronald Reagan was employed as the public spokesperson for an OPC front named the Crusade for Freedom. Reagan may not have known it, but 99% of the Crusade's funds came from clandestine accounts which were laundered through the Crusade to various organizations such as Radio Liberty, which employed Dulles' fascists. William Casey, who later became CIA director under Ronald Reagan and managed the 1980 Reagan-Bush campaign, also worked in Germany after World War II on Dulles' Nazi Freedom Fighters program. When he returned to New York, Casey headed up another OPC front, the International Rescue Committee, which sponsored the immigration of these fascists to the United States. Casey's committee replaced the International Red Cross as the sponsor for Dulles' recruits. And the sources for that information are listed. Now, taking a look at an element of this nation building in the United States, the Crusade for Freedom, one of the elements that was brought into the United States in order to help to specifically counteract the, quote, Jewish influence, unquote, in the New York, New Jersey area was a unit called the Vorkommando Moscow. The Vorkommando Moscow was an SS intelligence unit inextricably linked with the Holocaust, and that entire SS intelligence unit was brought into the United States and resettled complete and intact in the New York, New Jersey area as part of this nation building. Turning once again to the Loftus Aaron's text, Vorkommando Moscow was an elite forward unit of SS intelligence on the Soviet front. Its primary mission was anti-communist intelligence collection, but it also was responsible for security screening of the occupied populations in a broad sector of the Eastern Front, which held nearly 6 million Jews. Precisely this security and intelligence experience made the men of the unit so attractive to Western intelligence after the war, and led them to their journey to the United States and membership in Nixon's Republican ethnic groups, unquote. Vorkommando Moscow did not kill the Jews. It hired the collaborators who recruited the executioners who killed the Jews. From 1940 to 1942, this one small unit acted as an employment agency for the architects of Nazi genocide in Eastern Europe. Contrary to popular belief, while the Germans masterminded and controlled the machinery of the Holocaust, the foot soldiers who carried it out were not primarily Germans, but local volunteers from Poland, the Baltic states, Ukraine, and White Russia. Those non-Germans who wished to serve Hitler's new order first had to pass a security check by Vorkommando Moscow. And I would note that the commander of this unit had been Franz Alfred Sieks, an SS brigadier general, who had in turn been sprung from the defendant's dock at Nuremberg, and he later was involved in helping to set up the U.S. Special Forces, originally under CIA and State Department auspices. We looked at that in RFA program number one. And we're going to take a look now at the role, and bear in mind that this was an SS intelligence unit brought into the United States for the purposes specifically, explicitly, of nation building. We're going to take a look now at the incorporation of this into the Republican Party under Richard Nixon's presidency and by the elder George Bush, who later became director of the CIA, who was chairman of the Republican National Committee at this time. Turning once again to the secret war against the Jews, although our intelligence sources are not unanimous on this point, several say that George Bush was included among the handful of people who knew about Nixon's deal to bring the fascist groups into the Republican Party in 1972. Indeed, since Bush was the head of the National Committee, he was in the best position to supervise the transfer of the campaign staff's ethnic fascists into the Republican Party's own organization. A 1976 memo to Republican National Committee co-chairman Robert Carter contains an even more damning implication. During Bush's time as Republican National Committee chairman, he appointed Colonel J. Nimchick as director of the party's ethnic heritage groups. Nimchick's memo to Robert Carter praised Bush as having, quote, added needed strength and impetus, unquote, to the Republicans' ethnic recruitment effort. Nimchick reported that Bush, quote, had full knowledge of, and in the words of the memo, provided total support for the party's ethnic heritage groups. This basically was the incorporation of the Crusade for Freedom alumni into the Republican Party as a formal wing of the Republican Party. Bear in mind that Nixon oversaw that importation. The allegedly unknowing frontman for that was Ronald Reagan. It was Ronald Reagan's CIA director and 1980 campaign director, William Casey, who handled the State Department machinations to bring these people in. Turning again to the Loftus-Aaron's text. In 1972, Nixon appointed George Bush as head of the Republican National Committee. It was Bush who fulfilled Nixon's promise to make the ethnic émigré a permanent part of Republican politics. Skipping down. Nearly 20 years later, and after exposés in several respectable newspapers, Bush continued to recruit most of the same ethnic fascists, including Laszlo Pastor, for his own 1988 ethnic outreach program when he first ran for president. What we're going to do now is to move from the past to the present, and we're going to take a look at the younger George Bush's political utilization of the September 11th attacks, and I'm going to be advancing what is, yes, a conspiracy theory, and just as I've indicated that the political, economic, military, foreign policy, and domestic policy aspects of this event are inextricably linked, and just as I have been asked whether this was, in my opinion, a Pearl Harbor or a Reichstag fire, I believe it is both, as I indicated earlier in the program. We're going to turn now to the San Francisco Chronicle of Tuesday, January 29th of the year 2002, and we're going to listen to what some of the heirs of Ibn Saud have been up to, or at least what some of their subordinates have been up to. This again from the Chronicle of January 29th, a Tuesday of 2002. This is by Carl Nolte of the Chronicle. It's headlined, Detainees Are Mostly Saudis, subtitled Kingdom Asks U.S. to Hand Them Over. A report that about 100 of the Al-Qaeda and Taliban detainees being held in Cuba are Saudi Arabian citizens raised new complications for the Bush administration yesterday over what to do with the men accused of terrorism. Quote, I'll listen to all the legalisms and announce my decision when I make it, unquote, President Bush said in a White House appearance with Afghan interim leader Hamid Karzai. Bush's words were apparently designed to tamp down questions over the legal status of the detainees captured in Afghanistan, especially by Secretary of State Colin Powell. Powell indicated that he wanted the administration to consider giving the captured men, turning to the inside page, safeguards under the Geneva Convention. The Saudi government said yesterday that more than 100 of the 158 detainees are Saudi citizens, and it wanted the U.S. to hand them over for questioning. George Bush said he would give that some consideration. I would note that as I'm recording this on February 3rd of the year 2002, this past week, George Bush named Iran, Iraq, and North Korea as the axis of evil. Pointedly left out was Saudi Arabia and the economic leverage of the Saudis through A, petroleum, B, the reinvestment of petrodollars into the U.S. economy, and C, through their holding of U.S. foreign debt. The influence of the Saudis is profound. We're going to be taking a look later on in this program at some of the Bush family investments with the Saudis, including some that we have not touched on before. Again, I think the relative grace with which George Bush is handling the Saudis, the heirs to Ibn Saud, is not at all coincidental. We're going to turn now to an article from the New Yorker magazine of October 22nd of 2001. This was posted on the web on October 16th of 2001. It's by Seymour Hersh, and it's called Annals of National Security, King's Ransom, and it's about the Saudis. Talking about National Security Agency intercepts of Saudi royal family communications, the intercepts have demonstrated to analysts that by 1996, Saudi money was supporting Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda and other extremist groups in Afghanistan, Lebanon, Yemen, and Central Asia, and throughout the Persian Gulf region. Quote, 96 is the key year, one American intelligence official told me. Bin Laden hooked up to all the bad guys. It's like the Grand Alliance and had a capability for conducting large-scale operations, unquote. The Saudi regime, he said, had, quote, gone to the dark side, unquote. Now, I would add, taking a look at an item that will anticipate some of the discussion in the second half of the program, reflecting back on discussions in past programs, and also looking ahead to some of the material we'll be covering next week and in succeeding weeks, we're going to review one of the key elements in the Afghan support effort that saw the genesis of Osama bin Laden, and also World Trade Center 1 attack mastermind Ramzi Youssef. It was the anti-Soviet Afghan war that saw their genesis as warriors, and in turn, the one of the key elements in that was the World Muslim Congress, founded by SS Major Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, and an associate of Ibn Saud, among others. And we're going to take a look at the intersection between the World Muslim Congress, as we've seen, Haj Amin al-Husseini, the Saudi elite, the Saudi royal family, and American neo-Nazis. Based in Pakistan, the World Muslim Congress was initially headed by the Grand Mufti of Jerusalem, who, like his friend H. Keith Thompson, stood by the Third Reich until his death in 1974. A few years later, the World Muslim Congress, then headed by Pakistani Dr. Inamullah Khan, mailed Holocaust denial literature to every member of the U.S. Congress and the British Parliament. The World Muslim Congress's official mouthpiece, Muslim World, carried ads for the Protocols of the Elders of Zion and Henry Ford's The International Jew, skipping down. Dr. Khan also served as an advisor to the Saudi Arabian royal family, which lavished funds on the World Muslim Congress. In addition, the Saudi Arabian government retained the services of American neo-Nazi William Grimstead as a Washington lobbyist, skipping down. After the Soviet Union invaded Afghanistan in 1979, the World Muslim Congress began working closely with U.S. intelligence and Pakistani military officials who were covertly supporting the Afghan Mujahideen in their fight against the Soviet-installed regime in Kabul. This effort was strongly endorsed by Dr. Khan, who served for many years as the Pakistani representative of the Nazi-infested World Anti-Communist League, which played an important role in the Reagan administration's secret war in the Golden Crescent. That from the book The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, published in hardcover by Little Brown, copyright 1997. And that's a passage that we've dealt with before. Turning once again to the New Yorker article that was authored by Seymour Hersh, again from the New Yorker of October 22nd of 2001. Bear in mind that 15 of the 19 hijackers who were involved in the September 11th attacks were from Saudi Arabia. More than 100 of the 158 detainees at Camp X-Ray are Saudi. Bin Laden, of course, is from Saudi Arabia. And the day after the attacks, the Saudi ambassador to the U.S., Prince Sultan, hired a private jet and flew 12 members of the Bin Laden family out of the United States. They were based in Boston, where the two planes that attacked the World Trade Center took off from. This was before the FBI could question them, and at a time when nobody else could fly. The air traffic in the United States was shut down. Assessing a diplomat's view of the Saudi relationship to the United States, Seymour Hersh writes, quote, "The Saudis have been so indulged for so many decades. They are spoiled. They've always had it their way. There's hardly anything we could say that would impede the majestic instancy of their progress. We're their janissaries," unquote. The diplomat was referring to the captives who became elite troops of the Ottoman Empire. And that again from the Seymour Hersh New Yorker article. Looking ahead to the second half of the program, San Francisco Chronicle of Saturday, February 2nd of the year 2002, has an article by James Dow of the New York Times. It's headlined, "Bush Wants $120 Billion Budget Boost for the Pentagon." First paragraph, "In a military buildup rivaling that of the Reagan era, the Bush administration will call for increasing the Pentagon's yearly budget by $120 billion over the next 5 years to $451 billion in 2007, according to Defense Department documents." What we're going to be looking at in the second half of this program is nation building in the United States by some of the modern successors to this axis that we've been looking at in part one. We're going to be taking a look at the huge buildup for the war on terror and the Bush family's own connections to the Bin Laden family will be reviewed in the second half of the broadcast. We're going to take a look at this military outlay as not only an example of nation building in the United States. The Democratic Silicon Valley is going to be heavily focused in creating high-tech equipment for the war on terror. Southern California is going to get a huge outlay for the missile shield, which has gotten a boost from the attacks. This is also going to put the United States well over into the realm of deficit funding when the Bush tax cuts kick in, and that basically is going to be deep doo-doo for the United States. Now, I've alluded to other programs that are available from Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, 95005. Email mail, M-A-I-L, at spitfirelist.com. In the For the Record section of the Spitfire website, there will be an annotated, detailed description of For the Record program number 346 within a couple of days or 3 days of this broadcast. That website is at www.spitfirelist, one word, spitfirelist.com. Look in the For the Record section. In the description for 346, there will be links to two websites run by sister station WFMU, which have, for all intents and purposes, the whole For the Record series online. This concludes side one of For the Record program number 346, Pearl Harbor Meets the Reichstag Fire, Nation Building by the Underground Reich. This has been recorded on February 3rd of 2002. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.